Good morning, everyone. I hope you're doing well, and welcome to this address by Guy Debelle, Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, as Tony mentioned, on the Australian economy and monetary policy. The Australian economy is, of course, going through a period of immense change, stress and pressure at the moment in the post-COVID environment. If we're at the post-COVID environment yet, we're at a point where a lot of change has already occurred and more is likely to occur in the months ahead as the waves of the impact of the events of last February and March still wash over the economy. The impacts are being felt in many different sectors and in many different ways. And there are a couple of key drivers here that will help us recover our economy in the months and years ahead. And one of them is monetary policy, slightly constrained by record low interest rates. That will probably be with us for some time, but that does not mean that the Reserve Bank and monetary policy are left standing on the sidelines. In fact, one of the most recent bulletins from the Reserve Bank was called Unconventional Monetary Policy, where it's looking at other levers that the bank has to help drive recovery and drive our economy forward. Of course, we're coming up to the federal budget on October the 6th, where fiscal policy stimulus will be key parts of the recovery package going forward. But this situation we're in with maybe a two or a three speed economy at the moment means that we do need a full court press to drive people back to work and economic growth and wage growth in the period ahead. These are testing times for all of us and testing times for business in many different ways. But the key challenge here is to balance health and the economy. We look at where our national economy is at the moment. As I mentioned, it's almost a two or three speed economy. The West seems to be pushing ahead and is virtually back at pre-COVID levels, if not ahead of that, in terms of consumption. At the other end of the spectrum, Victoria continues to struggle and lags behind on every key indicator. And as lockdown continues, that gap will only serve to increase. And Victoria, being such a key part of the national economy, representing about 23% of the national economy, that impact is going to be with us for some time. And in the middle, we have the rest who seem to be getting back on their feet, some quicker than others, but the recovery process is very much underway. But today's event is an opportunity to hear from the Reserve Bank around what the future of monetary policy looks like in these times of low rates. As I mentioned, there are other options available to the bank to explore. And monetary policy remains a key driver of the economy, and what role it plays in this recovery will be different, but nonetheless just as important as in other downturns. To that end, on behalf of the Australian Industry Group, it's an enormous pleasure to welcome Guy Debelle, the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank. Guy is an Adelaide native. He's a graduate of the University of Adelaide and also of MIT. He's worked across a whole range of organisations, including Treasury and other organisations which help drive economic policy. Guy has been Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank since 2017 and is a key decision maker when it comes to the future of monetary policy and economic policy more broadly in Australia. Guy, it's an enormous pleasure to welcome you here today. To all AI Group members, thank you also for joining us today, and I hope we all get a lot out of today's presentation from Guy. As Tony mentioned, there'll be questions at the end, which Tony will moderate. But for now, over to you, Guy. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Innes, and thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk here. My talk today will cover three topics. First, I'll provide a perspective on the historic decline in output that both the Australian and global economies have experienced and discuss the current state of the Australian economy. Second, I'll explain how the monetary policy actions the Reserve Bank has taken are working to support the Australian economy and complementing the large fiscal response. And finally, I will outline possibilities for further monetary policy action should the Reserve Bank Board decide that is warranted. So let me first of all talk about the economic impact of the pandemic. The pandemic has resulted in an historic decline in output in the Australian and global economy. So what I'm showing you here are the GDP outcomes for a range of economies over the first two quarters of this year. And it's a truly daunting picture in terms of the size and the synchronized nature of the declines. What explains the large variation in outcomes you see across countries? You know, on the one hand, we've got China on the far left going down all the way to the sort of 25% contraction in output we've seen in India. So part of the explanation is the nature and management of the virus's impact. Some countries were affected more severely by the virus and had mobility restrictions for longer. So there's a very strong positive correlation between measures of mobility and GDP outcomes. Some part of the difference reflects the behavioural response of people beyond the direct effect of mobility restrictions. And those behavioural responses are having a significant impact on the shape of the economic recovery. A third source of variation is the share of the service sector of the economy, which has been most affected by shutdowns. And that is evident in countries like France and Spain, who are over on the right-hand side there, where tourism is a sizable part of the economy. If you're looking at this graph, then the one notable exception clearly is the country on the left, which is the Chinese economy. So China experienced a 10% decline in GDP in the March quarter, the first quarter of 2020, but reversed that decline in the second quarter, such that output was actually a little higher than at the end of 2019 by the end of June. And this reflects the earlier incidence, obviously, of the virus in China and consequently the earlier relaxation of restrictions. There has also been substantial fiscal policy support in China, though not so much from monetary policy. The form of the fiscal support has been different to that in other countries. In China, it has been directed at bolstering production rather than the income support that has comprised the bulk of the fiscal support in many other countries, including here in Australia. As a result, industrial production in China has recovered strongly, whereas the rebound in retail spending has been considerably less, as you can see in this picture. The strength of the industrial and construction sectors in China has seen strong demand for iron ore, with iron ore prices at multi-year highs. Turning to Australia, GDP declined by 7% in the June quarter. This is the largest peacetime economic contraction since the 1930s. While the decline was less than initially feared, it is still historically large. There are a number of aspects of the outcome that I would like to highlight. First, while GDP and employment recorded very large declines, household income actually rose. And that's quite a remarkable and highly unusual outcome. Normally in recessions, household income falls along with the decline in output and employment. This time that hasn't happened because of the income support from the government through JobKeeper and JobSeeker in particular. In addition, household cash flows were boosted by the superannuation withdrawals and lower interest rates, as well as the deferral of interest and rent payments. The fact that household income rose in the quarter does not mean that the stimulus was overdone. Absent the stimulus, the decline in GDP and employment would have been significantly larger and there would have been much greater financial hardship. That household saved a large amount of this income support means that their balance sheets are in a considerably better place than normally would be the case in a recession. They are much better placed to support the recovery in the economy as it unfolds. The transfer from the strong balance sheet of the government to bolster the balance sheet of the household sector is an entirely appropriate and timely policy response. The second thing I'd like to talk about is that business incomes were also supported by the JobKeeper payments, as well as the loan and rent deferrals. Nevertheless, business investment declined by 4% in the June quarter as the large rise in uncertainty significantly curtailed investment plans. The effect of the uncertainty has significantly outweighed the stimulatory effect of the decline in business borrowing costs. That decline in investment of 4% would have been even larger absent the effect of the instant asset write-off, which was evident in a pickup in business spending on computer equipment and vehicles towards the end of the June quarter. Turning to the labour market, hours worked remains a useful way to gauge what is happening, given the impact of JobKeeper on other measures of the labour market. The hours worked declined by 10% from peak to a trough around early May. Since then, they have grown by around 6% nationally, though that has been held back by the impact of the lockdown in Victoria. The unemployment rate in Australia was 6%, which was better than expected and is welcome. However, the recovery in the labour market is likely to be bumpy and uneven, and we still expect the unemployment rate to rise from here. The CPI outcome for the June quarter was affected by a number of unusual developments. My colleague Lucy Ellis talked about this in detail last month, and so I get you to have a look at that to get look at more detail around that CPI outcome, but just a few points on it. Inflation has been affected by some very, very large relative price movements at the moment. In the June quarter, there were large declines in childcare costs and petrol, both of which will be partly reversed in the current quarter, while some retail prices rose at a relatively rapid rate in the June quarter. But I do not see that there is any risk of a sustained rise in inflation while there remains considerable spare capacity in the economy. In particular, the high unemployment rate will mean that wage growth, which was not strong pre the pandemic, will remain subdued. As wage costs are a major factor affecting prices, inflation will remain contained for some time. Moreover, the decline in rents that were evident in the June quarter, as a large amount of extra supply came into the rental market, are also likely to persist and will also restrain inflation. So we are now nearing the end of the September quarter. How is the Australian economy evolving after that large decline in output? Most indicators of activity and the labour market troughed in early May. Since then, we have seen a recovery in a number of these indicators, though there has been substantial variation across the country. And I'll use the payrolls data that the ABS has now started to publish to illustrate this. As you can see in this graph, the strongest recovery has been in WA. Part of that recovery in WA reflects the turnaround in investment in the resources sector that was already in train before the onset of the pandemic. There has also been a sharp rebound in activity in the housing sector in WA, boosted by the support from both the federal and state governments. The pickup in WA has been such that some of the bank's liaison contacts are reporting that in some skill areas, they are finding it hard to find labour, particularly with the border closures. At the other end of the scale, as you can see, is Victoria, where the impact of the lockdown is very evident. We estimate that the lockdown in Victoria subtracted around 2% from national GDP in the September quarter. Overall, the recovery has not been a rapid bounce, but more of a slow grind. The virus is having its effect, particularly because of the lockdown in Victoria, but so too is the shortfall in demand that occurs in recessionary conditions. That shortfall in demand will be a significant brake on the recovery. Until households and businesses are confident about future demand and income, they will be reluctant to spend and invest. Let me now turn to talk about the effect of monetary policy actions. Fiscal policy is having the largest impact in shaping the outcomes in the economy, but the monetary policy actions are also having a material influence. The monetary policy actions taken by the Reserve Bank since March has a number of elements which complement each other. They are aimed at supporting the recovery by lowering borrowing rates for households and business, as well as the government, and supporting the supply of credit. The various monetary policy actions have led to a significant increase in the size of the RBA's balance sheet from $170 billion in February to around $300 billion currently. I'll spell this out in more detail in a minute. The consequent large amount of liquidity in the system is underpinning low money market rates for the financial system. The cash rate and bank bill swap rates, BBSW, which are the two key benchmarks in the Australian economy, are at historic lows, as you can see in this picture. Given these rates underpin the whole spectrum of bank funding costs, those funding costs have declined to historically low levels. And those low funding costs in turn have been passed through to record low borrowing costs for households and businesses. So the cash rate target was reduced to 25 basis points back in March. The traded cash rate, as you can see here, sits below that at around 13 basis points currently, given the abundance of liquidity in the financial system, reflected in the large rise in exchange settlement balances, which are the balances the banking system holds at the Reserve Bank. ES balances have risen to around $50 billion currently and were as high as $90 billion in recent months, considerably larger than the $2 to $3 billion that prevailed before the pandemic. The low level of the cash rate is anchored by the interest rate paid on the banks on those balances at the RBA, which is set at 10 basis points. So those high level of ES balance is a result of a number of actions by the Reserve Bank. First, it reflects the large provision of liquidity in the early days of the pandemic through the bank's daily market operations. Second, it is a direct consequence of the bank's purchases of government bonds. When the Reserve Bank buys bonds in the secondary market, it directly boosts the banking system's deposits. The third driver of that increase in ES balances is the funds provided under the Term Funding Facility, or TFF, which have substantially increased liquidity. These funds are lent by the Reserve Bank to the banking system for a term of 3 years and at a fixed rate of 25 basis points. The initial allowance of the TFF, which was introduced in March, was 3% of credit extended by the banking system, or $84 billion. That allowance has been gradually taken up over the past 6 months, and particularly in recent weeks, such that take-up currently stands at around $75 billion. Different types of institutions, whether large, medium-sized or small, have accessed similar shares of funding from the TFF. The Reserve Bank Board had announced an extension of the TFF following its September meeting. This amounts to an additional 2% of credit and is available to be drawn until June 2021. Why did the board take this decision? Given the protracted nature of the recovery, the board considered it appropriate to provide more funding and for a longer period to support the Australian economy in the recovery. The larger amount of funding available, which is now at least 5% of total credit, is a further easing in the stance of monetary policy, will result in a further material expansion of the RBA's balance sheet over the next 3 years. So what impact are we seeing from the take-up of the TFF? First, the TFF has lowered lending rates by lowering bank funding costs. The TFF funding is considerably cheaper than wholesale funding of similar maturity. Second, it is having a noticeable effect on bank funding. It is important to keep in mind that funding is fungible for banks, so it's not really possible to say to what purpose particular sources of funds are being put or which they are replacing. But as you can see in this picture here, the funding structure of the banking system has changed significantly over the past 6 months as a result of the TFF, together with the increase in deposit funding of the banks. As you can see here, there's been a reduction in offshore wholesale funding, which is a very similar size to the take-up of TFF funding. But the amount of domestic wholesale funding is actually little change. So banks have chosen to let their offshore funding roll off as it's matured. The banks can use the TFF funds to expand their lending to households and businesses, to replace more expensive sources of funding, as you can see here, or to buy other assets, including government debt. Funding is fungible, as I said, but we can see that all of these options are being taken up by the banks. The final element of the board's package is the target for the 3-year Australian government bond yield. This is a price-based target for bond purchases rather than the quantitative target for bond purchases announced by many other central banks. You can think of it as an extension of the cash rate target, where the target is for 3 years rather than overnight. That increased horizon for the target is aligned with the board's forward guidance, which I'll come to in a minute. In saying that it is a price-based target, it is important to remember that in maintaining the 3-year yield target, the bank is still buying the quantities of bonds required to achieve the target. Those bond purchases have their effect on maintaining the 3-year yield at the target, but they also have the same portfolio substitution effect as the quantitative easing programs of other central banks. The 3-year yield target is for the Australian government bond nearest to a 3-year maturity. Since the introduction of the target in March, that bond has been the April 2023 maturity, so the red line you can see on the graph here. In a few weeks' time, it will switch to being the April 2024 maturity, as that comes closest to being 3 years to maturity. There is a reasonable amount of substitutability between these two bonds, as they are both in the 3-year futures basket. And we wouldn't want a dislocative jump as the target bond changes. And indeed, we have seen the spread between these two bonds narrow as the market has focused on this transition, and you can see that in the graph here. The bank has been purchasing both bonds in our operations in recent weeks to maintain the target. It is worth reiterating that there are two related but separate motivations for the bank's government bond purchases since March. The first is to achieve the board's target for the 3-year Australian government bond yield, shown here. The second objective is to address any dysfunction in the Australian and state government bond markets. As you can see on the graph here, the three-year yield declined reasonably quickly to the target, so it didn't require large purchases to actually achieve the target. Rather, the bulk of the purchases in March and April was to address dysfunction in government bond markets. The bank purchased both Australian government securities, Commonwealth government securities, and semis out to a maturity of 10 years to help restore market function. Since the bond market has returned to functioning normally, purchases have been directed to maintaining the three-year target. The bank continues to stand ready to purchase both AGS and semis to help support market functioning. I said earlier that the three-year yield target is closely aligned with the board's forward guidance about the future direction of the cash rate target. The board has consistently stated that it will not increase the cash rate until progress has been made towards full employment, and it is confident that inflation will be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target band. In the August statement on monetary policy, the forecast was for the unemployment rate to rise to 10% at the end of the year, and in the central scenario, to gradually decline to be 7% by the end of 2022. While the recent labour market release indicates outcomes could be better than this, there would still need to be a significant further decline in the unemployment rate before the Australian labour market would be nearing full employment. Prior to the pandemic, the unemployment rate was around 5%. That was not low enough to generate sufficient wage growth consistent with achieving the inflation target. Under the central scenario, it would be more than 3 years before sufficient progress was being made towards full employment to be confident that inflation will be sustainably within the target band. In this scenario, it is highly unlikely that the cash rate will be raised over that three-year time horizon. And this aligns with the target for the three-year bond yield of around 25 basis points. So to summarise, the bond purchases and the TFF funding have resulted in a large expansion in the RBA balance sheet. The balance sheet has nearly doubled from $170 billion to $300 billion, which is a substantial easing in monetary policy. In many ways, these actions are as stimulatory as a quantitative easing program of the same time size. They are providing substantial liquidity to Australian financial markets and underpinning the historically low level of interest rates in the Australian economy. Given the outlook for inflation and employment is not consistent with the bank's objectives over the period ahead, the board continues to assess other policy options. And the governor talked about these options at the Anika Foundation event in July. One option considered is to buy bonds further out along the curve, supplementing the three-year yield target. Purchases would still be conducted to maintain the target for the three-year bond, but additional purchases could occur further out the curve on a regular basis. This would have the effect of further lowering government bond rates at longer maturities. Very few financial instruments in Australia price off these yields, and this is in contrast to the US, say, where the 10-year Treasury yield is a key pricing benchmark for mortgage rates. The board is focused on the three-year yield target as the three-year yield as the target in Australia, because Australian financial instruments price predominantly off the shorter end of the curve. These institutional differences across countries are important and affect the design and transmission of monetary policy actions. Bond purchases have a portfolio balance effect in addition to the interest rate effect. When a central bank buys government bonds, it is exchanging a shorter duration asset, cash, for a longer duration one, namely the bond. And that incentivizes investors to switch into other financial assets, including potentially foreign assets, to get that duration exposure. This lowers interest rates on other financial assets and can also contribute to a lower exchange rate. It is difficult to separate the portfolio balance effect from the effect of lower government bond rates empirically, but nevertheless, additional bond purchases would have some effect in lowering longer-term interest rates. That said, the current level of government bond rates is not a constraint on the fiscal decisions of the Australian and state governments. They all have strong balance sheets with debt stocks that are low relative to other countries, even taking account of the current sizable fiscal stimulus. The increase in public debt is definitely manageable. Moreover, there is not, in my judgment, a trade-off between debt and supporting the Australian economy in the current circumstance. Absent the fiscal stimulus, the Australian economy would be significantly weaker and debt levels even higher. And this is particularly so with interest rates at their historically low levels, where the growth benefit from the fiscal stimulus will improve the debt dynamics and help service the debt in the future. Foreign exchange intervention is another potential policy option. However, with the Australian dollar broadly aligned with its fundamentals, It is not clear this would be effective in the current circumstance. The Swiss experience over the past decade, particularly ahead of the introduction of the ceiling on the Swiss franc, illustrates the issues that can arise in terms of the effectiveness of foreign exchange intervention when a currency is not far from its fundamental value. It's also important to remember that the exchange rate is a relative price. Part of the recent movements in the Australian dollar reflects the depreciation of the US dollar against other major currencies. It also reflects the high price of iron ore I mentioned earlier. The relatively better growth outcomes in Australia compared with other economies are having an influence too. That said, a lower exchange rate would definitely be beneficial for the Australian economy, so we are continuing to watch developments in the FX market carefully. A third option is to lower the current structure of rates in the economy a little more without going into negative territory. The rate we pay on ES balances is currently 10 basis points. The three-year yield target is at 25 basis points, and the borrowing rate of the TFF is also 25 basis points. It is possible, obviously, to further reduce these interest rates. A fourth option is negative rates, and the governor has talked about this a number of times before. Let me just make a couple of points here. The empirical evidence on negative rates is mixed. In the short term, they can contribute to a lower exchange rate. In the medium term, the effectiveness of negative rates can wane, including through the effect on the financial system. Negative rates can also encourage more saving as households look to preserve the value of their saving, particularly in an environment where they are already inclined to save rather than spend. To date, those economies with negative policy rates have not lowered them further. Instead, they have eased monetary policy settings through other means. So let me now wrap up. Australian and the global economies have undergone historic contractions as a result of the pandemic. We are now in a gradual and uneven recovery. The recovery is being supported by sizable fiscal stimulus, particularly in terms of income support for households and business. Monetary policy is playing its role in supporting the economy. There has been a large expansion in the RBA balance sheet resulting from the board's policy actions. This expansion comes from the TFF and the government bond purchases to achieve the yield target and address dysfunction in the bond market. This constitutes a substantial easing in monetary policy. These actions are underpinning the historically low interest rates for households and business, as well as the government. At its September meeting, the board decided to further expand and extend the size of the TFF, which will further increase the size of the bank's balance sheet. As the outlook for the Australian economy unfolds, the board will continue to assess the merits of the range of monetary policy options to best support the economic recovery. So let me finish there and happy to answer questions. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Guy. Look, I'm going to go to Innes for the first question, but just a reminder, you know, put your questions in the chat box on your screen, your Q&A box on the screen, and I'll try and get to those. And if you're from the media, can you? Some attendees say anonymous, so I'd really need to know if you're from the media or not. Can you just put your organisation at the start of that question so I can preface the question with that? But thanks very much for that, Guy, and I'll just go over to Innes now. You've got a question for the Deputy Governor, Innes.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, Guy, for that presentation. These are interesting times that we live in. You described the recovery thus far as grinding as well as gradual and uneven. Looking at that three-year horizon, particularly around bond purchases and the like, over the 3 years, as we get into that next 3 years, does the pressure to look to other stimulus measures, the ones you talked around quantitative easing, negative rates, et cetera, does that pressure increase, do you believe, over time? Or at this stage, you know, is the outlook just to stick to the strategy that you have at the moment? So I suppose sort of, as we go through this uneven recovery, one step forward, two steps back at some points, you know, how will the pressure sort of impact on policy settings, do you believe?
Well, I mean, as I said at the end, I mean, we'll see how the outlook for the Australian economy unfolds, and the board will continue to assess, you know, the merits of the various ranges of monetary options that we have. That said, as I said earlier, you know, at the end of that three-year horizon, under the central scenario, we still have an unemployment rate of 7%, and in all likelihood, inflation a bit on the low side. So, hence the need for the board to continue to assess the merits of the range of monetary policy options that that we have available. And I suppose, as I said earlier in the talk, we decided to further expand and extend the size of the TFF at the September meeting, in part because of the recovery looking to be more protracted than previously had appeared to be the case.
Okay. A good question from Mary Thompson. How important is federal, state and privately funded infrastructure investment to Australia's recovery?
It is important. I would broaden that out a little bit and say, the fiscal stimulus that we're getting from the Commonwealth, from the federal and state governments is very important, and a reasonable chunk of that is spending on infrastructure, particularly at both the Commonwealth and state levels. So yes, that is an important part of the support that's coming. We are, one of the things I mentioned earlier is that, I think what businesses, you're all in business, you can probably answer this better than I, but what people want to see is some certainty, get some sense around the future path of demand. And one source of that demand is infrastructure spending for a number of parts of the business community. And so having that certainty around that pipeline of investment is particularly important.
It's from Stephen J. Haller. Given that interest rates globally are so low and that the level of government support has been so great, how can we avoid a depression like the one in the 30s? Good question.
So far, the Australian economy has come off its trough in May. So it's plausible that the worst is behind us. But as I said, the recovery from here is potentially more of a slow grind. So with any luck, we've seen the maximum point of contraction, which in our case in total was around 8%. So I think one thing we are seeing globally is extensive fiscal support. And so we aren't seeing the sort of some of the more contractionary fiscal and monetary support for that matter, or monetary policy action, sorry, that we saw around the Great Depression. So, I think the size and rapidity of the policy response this time around, has been extremely large, and it has meant that we've seen less of a contraction than we might otherwise have seen. And as I said, with any luck, avoiding the sort of outcomes that we saw back in the 30s.
And going back to that first chart, the Chinese chart, and a few others, they've talked about the Nike swish in it. It seems to go down and straight back up. Yep. And that's a question from an anonymous attendee, as I mentioned before. Again, put your questions in the Q&A down there. Please elaborate on why the Chinese market is the only one that has seen such a huge and quick recovery.
As I said, I think it's interesting to look at what's going on there, because you've seen the recovery in production, but you haven't seen the recovery in retail spending. In contrast here, and Innes mentioned this earlier, so retail spending has actually held up. It's not even held up. It's actually grown quite strongly in Australia. In contrast, we've seen much more subdued recovery on the production side of things. And in part, that reflects the nature of the fiscal policy support. So the bulk of the fiscal policy support here and in many other countries has been income support, which has supported the household sector and the business sector as well. And on the household sector side, you've seen some of that translate into higher spending, particularly in the retail sector. In China, there hasn't been anywhere near as much income support provided to the household sector. They don't have much of a social safety net, whereas the bulk of the support has been very much directed at production. Some part of the difference is, as I said, is also timing. So that China started to come out of the lockdown and the restrictions on mobility much ahead of everyone else. So their second quarter outcome is supported by the fact that they were already on the path to recovery earlier than other countries. So some part of this will also just have to wait and see how things play out over the coming months.
I've got a first media question from John Keogh at the Australian Financial Review. John asks, the potential future monetary policy options you are considering, that's the questions about that. Is that something imminent, or would the RBA board prefer more time to assess the outlook for the economy?
Well, we have a meeting every month, and at each meeting we continue to assess the merits of the range of monetary options to best support the economy. As I said, I'm not going to, it's a decision that we reassess every board meeting.
Good try. Simon Roy from Amcor. What is the RBA's expectation for the economy as the variety of subsidies start to come off, the JobKeeper, the JobSeeker, mortgage delays, etc.? Is there a risk of further downward slide and deeper slide?
I mean, as Innes mentioned earlier, obviously we've got the budget coming up in October, so we'll have to obviously take account of what is announced there. And you know, I don't have any particular insight as to what that is going to be. It's true that some of the income support is tapering off over the coming months. That said, as I said earlier, household incomes and household cash flows have been boosted by a number of measures, and particularly by the extensive income support provided to date. And the household sector has actually saved a reasonable amount of that, which in aggregate at least will give, you know, give some capacity to, you know, to deal with that expected taper in that degree of income support. I mean, our outlook does encompass what we knew in terms of policy support at the time in August, and so we had taken some account of that, of that decline in income. But as I said, it is worth bearing in mind that household balance sheets have been very much bolstered by the amount of income support to date, and business balance sheets for that matter, too. But yeah, that is something we will be keeping a close eye on over the coming months.
Okay, we've got a couple here from anonymous attendees, and there's quite a few coming in. We've got another 20 minutes, hopefully. So the question is, has the lockdown in Queensland and Victoria, are they the main reasons why we've not experienced a V-shaped recovery? And subset of that question, is it better to not have a V-shaped recovery from the RBA's point of view?
I don't really have any, you know, I've got to remember we're talking about health outcomes as well as economic outcomes here. I'm not going to second guess anyone's assessment around that. The lockdown in Victoria certainly has an impact on economic outcomes. That's, you know, incontrovertible. And as I said earlier, we think it's probably going to subtract a couple of percentage points off GDP in the quarter we're in currently. The appropriateness of that or not, I'll leave to others. We deal with the outcomes that we see in front of us.
Okay, and the V-shaped recovery, it's good, bad, different?
Well, I think I would have thought a V-shaped recovery is better than one which is going the opposite way. I would,
I guess the point is it better to have a gradual improvement than sudden jump? That more sustainable?
Well, I mean, the nature of this episode is very different from anything we've seen for, 100 years, basically. The economic contraction was generated by a deliberate decision to shut down parts of the economy, turn them off, basically. And so in that sense, the sooner, if you can turn them back on, then I can't see there's anything, and if that's aligned with your health objectives, then, I don't see any problems created by that. The considerations really are much more around the health side. I don't see any economic problems created by that.
Okay. So this one's, I know you touched on it, this one's probably asking for an elaboration. Why would the RBA not recommend increased money supply policy for the rest of this and all of 2021?
We are, as I said earlier, our balance sheet has expanded, it's almost doubled between March and now. And given the further expansion in the TFF we announced at a September meeting, it's going to go up, a decently large amount again. So just in terms of sort of liquidity in the system, it is actually going to continue to grow over the next 6 months.
Okay. This one here, it's definitely worth clarifying, I think, given the questions from Swati Pandey. In previous speeches, Governor Lowe has indicated that negative rates was not on the table in Australia, saying it was, quote, extraordinarily unlikely. Are you saying that negative rates are now on the table?
No, I'm just saying it's an option. I'm not saying whatever I'm saying is completely aligned with whatever Phil's said on this before. I'm just saying it is an option. And as the other three options I talked about, I'm not saying anything about the relative likelihood, saying anything new about the relative likelihood of any of those.
Yep. And you did describe the failure of those policies in other places. Sophie Rodriguez from the Central Bank Intel, another media questions. You said in a few weeks' time, the RBA will switch the three-year yield target to April 2024 maturity. Given that April is 6 months away, that'd be right. Does it mean your yield target would be closer to 3.5 years? And 3 years is a very technical question, I think.
I said in the speech, we don't have a 3.5 year bond. So, you know, we have the bonds that we have and the maturity structure that they have. So, you know, I said it's the one which is closest to the 3 year target. That's the target. I think made it reasonably clear, as clear as I could, at least in the speech, that we are targeting the bond which is closest to 3 years, and then come about this time next month, that switch, you know, the calendar just switches from one to the other.
I'm sure Sophia can get that from the website, and probably up after this, if not already, from the RBA website. So another question from the media, Pat Commons from The Australian. Hi, Pat. What's the risk that the tapering and eventual removal of extraordinary income support measures over coming months and into 2022 and the expiry of the deferral of interest payments for many businesses and households derails the economic recovery? Does it raise the risk of a double dip recession in 2022 as the sizable fiscal stimulus is removed?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I don't know the details of what the government's got intending to announce in October. I mean, they are looking outward and assessing fiscal policy appropriately. As I said, one thing to bear in mind is that a decently large amount of that extraordinary income support has been saved by both households and businesses, for that matter, which does at least mean their balance sheets have got that extra income than they would normally have in a recession. So that needs to be taken account of as you think about the impact of that tapering. But, you know, that is something that both we and the government are going to be carefully looking at over the coming months.
So this one's from Robert Minkus. Can you go into more detail as to why intervention on keeping the Australian dollar down is not an option, and what would need to change to move to intervention? Are there circumstances in Switzerland that differentiate it to Australia's situation that make it a better option to intervene in maintaining currency value?
I mean, the point I was trying to get across is that when an exchange rate is around about its fundamentals, then intervention can be challenging, particularly given the size of the FX market. That said, it is something that continues to be on the table. And if the exchange, a lower Australian dollar is certainly beneficial to the shape of the economic economic recovery here, and so it's something we continue to watch carefully. But as the Swiss experience showed, that when when your exchange rate is around fundamentals, then large scale intervention it's not entirely clear how effective that can be. But that said, it is something, it's something we continue to watch is the movements in the exchange rate and watch them carefully.
So it's a question from Grant at Matrix, and that's a big picture question beyond the current crisis. How do you see the long-term impact of the debt burden on the economy over the next coming decades?
So as I said here, and I also said in an earlier speech, I think we've got to be careful how we think about, the debt situation, particularly on the public side in particular, in the sense that the counterfactual doesn't obviously lead to lower debt. So if there was less fiscal support, the economy would be in worse shape and potentially debt levels would be even higher. The other point to bear, another way of putting that is the fiscal stimulus that is in place here and in other countries for that matter at the moment is leading to better outcomes for the economy, which actually improves the fiscal position down the track. So I do think we've got to think about that intertemporal picture. The other point to note is with debt servicing costs as low as they are and considerably lower than any plausible path for the nominal GDP from here, that makes the debt eminently serviceable. So I don't see it so much as, it's not a burden that we're leaving to future generations. Absent the stimulus that's been put in place now, those future generations would be inheriting an economy which would be a hell of a lot worse than it would be without that stimulus.
Ewan's asked a question, and it came in before the others, so it's a similar one about the JobKeeper weaning off. But he does raise, Ewan Black from The New Daily, he does raise the question about zombie firms. What's the bank's view of this idea that there's a lot of companies that could potentially disappear when all the support goes?
I mean, that's something to bear in mind. That said, at the moment, I think, you know, I think the decision to err on the side of support, I think, is the right thing for the current circumstance. That's something to bear in mind down the track. But I think we're, you know, in the situation we're in at the moment, I would certainly think the right decision is to err on too much support rather than too little support, and those sort of considerations we probably need, would need to be taken into account going, over the period ahead. But as I said, to date, I think the main point has been to provide the appropriate degree of support for the economy. You know, if you think about a world where instead you've just shut down parts of the economy, I don't think we don't today have a great sense of to what the economy will be even as we start to, what it will look like as we start to open up again. So I think it's possibly a little too premature to be able to say, well, you know, this part of the economy is going to come back, this part of the economy is not going to come back as we hopefully return to something approaching the sort of pre-pandemic environment.
Okay. So this question is from our own chief AI group chief economist, Julie Toth. And she says, to what extent has the growth in Australian retail spending simply displaced spending on services and particularly leisure travel services because people are staying home, going to supermarkets and Bunnings instead of restaurants and holidays, which just comes off what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say displaced. I mean, it's been done instead of the fact that they couldn't spend on those other things. I mean, the national accounts gives you the overall story when you look at terms of what happened to aggregate consumption. So notwithstanding the fact that retail was up, consumption was actually down in total, reflecting the fact that you couldn't spend on services, including some of the ones that Julie mentioned. So it is, so households have got this large amount of income. They've been able to spend on what they can spend. And one of the things they can spend on is retail. And that's, in aggregate, at least being pretty strong. But you're right, there are other things that they haven't been able to spend on. And the net of all of that is household incomes were up, household consumption was down, and household savings are up.
So we're covering some of the same ground, but from this attendee, and I think Innes has got a comment that he'd like to add a comment to this question as well. What's the RBA's view on targeted support towards certain parts of the economy, that is tourism, aviation, education, rather than the economy overall?
I think I will leave that for the fiscal policy decision makers. I mean, we're, our role is to provide support for the economy in aggregate, and, it's up to others, most obviously the government, to make the decision as to what is the appropriate way that they need to deploy their fiscal support.
Okay. Did you want to comment on that, Innes, or am I misreading your chat box there? Sounds not. Okay, so the next one's from, and we're getting down towards the end of the questions here, so if you've got any questions, there is still a few minutes left. This question's from Craig from Skillset. We've seen some significant expenditure from government on job retention initiatives, JobKeeper, apprentice wages, etc. Given the total unemployment rate is a key factor in decision-making and one of the keys to economic recovery, is there an argument for more effort in terms of job creation initiatives?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I don't know what's coming in the budget, but from at least some of the things I read and hear in the public domain, I think there is a recognition that demand support, I mean, Steve Kennedy made this point the other day, that demand support is going to be a key element of the fiscal policy support going forward, not necessarily instead of, but certainly complementing the income support. So very much to that point, I would completely agree. Demand support is going to be a key element, and that demand support coming from both the federal and the state governments, including, through the sort of infrastructure stuff we were talking about earlier, but through other means of demand support. But yeah, I think that is going to be, we'll see what comes to pass in October and in the subsequent state budgets as well. But yeah, demand support is going to be certainly a very important element of the fiscal policy response going forward.
And you mentioned in your address as well that interest rates would pretty well wouldn't go up until after we had full employment. Just can you remind people what full employment is? Because it's got various definitions.
I mean, what I said is until we get to the point where, we can see inflation sustainably within the, where we would like it within the target band, that will require a substantially lower unemployment rate. I mentioned that prior to all of this, an unemployment rate of 5% wasn't quite enough to get wages up. I mean, what we don't know is how the shape of the labour market's going to change as a result of all of this. But whatever it is, it's a hell of a, you know, it's significantly lower than what the unemployment rate is now and what it is in prospect over the next few years.
Okay. This is an anonymous one. If the June quarter was 7% down, what is the RBA expecting in the September quarter?
I mean, we will update our forecasts in when we do it next, November, taking into account the information, you know, what we've learned since then. We had the forecast we put out in August had a, you know, not, you know, minimal or barely any or maybe even slightly negative growth in the September quarter, based on what we knew then. All of this stuff evolves pretty quickly. That did take reasonable account of the Victorian lockdown. So, I mean, as I said, I don't think I want to be too precise in terms of what our forecast is for on a quarter by quarter basis. What we're more looking at is the trajectory, you know, over the next 2 or 3 years. And as I said earlier, I think that's looking more like much, you know, it's going to be bumpy and uneven. There'll be, you know, some ups, some downs. And it looks like being more of a slow grind than a rapid return to sort of pre-pandemic levels or growth rates.
I've got a couple of last questions there, from media. So Michael Heath again from Bloomberg, a couple of acronyms there. Is the expanded TFF a version of QE, quantitative easing, I guess? Do you expect it to help restrain the A-dollar?
So I think, I mean, the point I was trying to get across in the speech was that the quantitative easing and the TFF both expand a central bank's balance sheet. And so if they're of the same size, then the expansion in central bank balance sheet's the same. They work through slightly different means, but I think they share a lot of the same characteristics. And as I said, if one way of assessing the stance of monetary policy is to look at the size of the expansion in the central bank balance sheet, and in, you know, both have pretty much the same sort of impact.
Okay. And I'll just take the last question here as we're about to run out of time. Pat Commons again from the Oz. What is the RBA's bank liaison telling you about how deferred mortgages and business loans are returning to normal or being extended or restructured? Have you got any update on that?
We're actually doing a round of bank liaison right now, so I don't have the impact of that. But I mean, what we have heard is what you've heard from the various bank profit reports over the last little while, is that a number of their customers who had originally deferred have started, both households and businesses have started to repay, but others, you know, others continue, you know, have taken the deferral through until next year. I think I would say the summary picture is we haven't seen necessarily that many more come in, you know, looking for a deferral, but we have seen some people decide to actually start making those payments again. So the number is, I think, net terms has come down.
Okay. And I will just sneak one last one in from Simon again, Simon Roy at Amcor. Australians hold significant private debt, particularly with regard to mortgages, given the high relative house prices here. Is there any appetite to encourage US-style long-term fixed mortgage instruments, 15 or 30-year mortgages, given this could provide the opportunity for consumers to lock in and guarantee very low rates for the long term?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, one thing which is actually helping in the opposite direction at the moment is the fact that we have variable rate mortgages rather than fixed rate mortgages locked in for 30 years. So households have been able to make substantial, and they have been, making substantial extra repayments on their mortgages as a result of that large amount of saving that they've been doing over the last few months. So if you have, you know, the standard US rate, fixed rate mortgage wouldn't allow you to do that. So to some extent, at least for the time being, the households have been actually benefiting from the fact that they've got variable rate mortgages and can make sort of the free option to repay those mortgages faster. So at least at the moment, it's actually working well. I mean, in the end, you know, you can go ahead, and we have seen more people take out fixed rate mortgages, but that's fixed for 3 or 5 years. But the share of new mortgages which have been fixed rates has actually been going up over the last few months.
Okay, that's good. Because the Americans also have a tax-deductible home loan, yep. which is, I think, in some places, that'd be a very popular government policy here, I think. But Innes is there now. Innes, you got a last question or a comment or wrap up?
Thanks, Tony, and thanks, Guy. If I may, Guy, two quick questions. One in relation to the one that was asked before about the September GDP figure. You talked a bit about it being a grind, and others talk about in policy making, talk about this being a 5-year plus recovery process. Does that number for September really matter? You know, if it's in or around zero plus or minus just a little bit, does that really matter, or is that more a confidence measure? And secondly, we haven't talked about the international situation at all. We've got, what's going on regionally with China. We've got coronavirus, of course. We've got Brexit, which everyone seems to forget is still to be resolved. We've got the US election in, 6 or 7 weeks. The global environment is perhaps more volatile than ever. What does that volatility mean to monetary policy and thinking around monetary policy? And I guess where I'm going out of that is, does the US election matter much too when it comes to policy settings going forward?
They're all sources of uncertainty, as you said, Innes. And we have a lot of uncertainty restraint. You know, it's having an impact here and globally on investment decisions, and all of those things you mentioned are going to have that uncertainty. That impact on investment decisions until some of that uncertainty is resolved. The US election may be resolved sooner rather than later, maybe resolved on November the 3rd, maybe not. But those other sources of uncertainty, as you said, are going to be prevalent for a while. And that does, that uncertain environment is clearly having an impact on investment decisions here and around the world. And that's something we have to take account of in our monetary policy deliberations. On the September quarter outcome, maybe it has an impact on confidence in terms of how the number actually prints. But as I said earlier, it's really what's going to matter is the sort of trajectory over the next few years, I think, rather than any particular outcome, and particularly your outcome, which was affected in this case by affected by a number of things, but particularly the lockdown in Victoria, which, with any luck, maybe a more positive story on that in the coming weeks. But, the number will be whatever it will be, and, we'll take account of that. But I think from our point of view, it's sort of looking at the more medium-term picture over the next 2 or 3 years, really.
Last word, Innes. Okay.
Thank you. And Guy, thank you very much for joining us today. I mean, I hate to say it, we do live in interesting times, but they're also fascinating times, but challenging times. And today you've given us a very good outlook and snapshot of where monetary policy is going, the different instruments at play, and these are very important for those within business and in the wider community to understand as we navigate these waters ahead. So, thank you very much for joining us today, Guy. Much appreciated, and I appreciate your candour. Thanks to everyone who's joined us today, including our members by the hundreds. Thank you for being with us today. Much appreciated, and thank you for your support. Thanks again, Guy. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.